The From Day One podcast is brought to you by The Bridge and the Made in New York Media Center.
Hi, I'm Nick Bailey, and this is the From Day One podcast. Today we're talking to Brian Stream. He's the CEO and founder of Arobo, a drone operating company that specializes in high-quality aerial imaging cinematography. A 29-year-old graduate of NYU's Tisch School, Stream is not your typical CEO, or at least not one you'd expect at the helm of a service the cutting edge of drone technology. Stream's fascination is in moving the camera through three-dimensional space, an idea that first came to him in 2013, when Stream was still working as a producer in his own production company. After watching a video of a flying drone, he knew the technology was about to be the next big thing. Stream launched Arobo in 2015 and has had a number of high-profile customers since then, including Amazon, Netflix, ESPN, and Fox. For a daily rate, Arobo provides production companies with drones, cameras, and even the pilots who will operate the drones. The idea is to allow directors to focus on directing, rather than feeling the pressure of adding drone piloting to their repertoire. Stream's team is headquartered in Industry City in the Sunset Park neighborhood here in Brooklyn, despite regulations that make it illegal to fly drones anywhere in the city. Arobo has also had a small operation in LA, hopes to grow the LA team more to take on more Hollywood projects in the near future. Thanks for joining us, Brian.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So where are you from?
I was born in Queens, New York, Bayside. Parents moved to Jersey when I was like seven, and then I went to NYU Film School. So I've, for one reason or the other, I kind of just stayed in New York after graduating out of laziness or just not knowing what else to do.
And what brought you to NYU Film School? What was your passion?
You know, since I was a young kid, I've been fascinated with movies, technology. You know, film is a is an art form, but it's also like a very technical art form. That's kind of always, you know, merged all of my passions. So it just always made sense. I suppose a lot of people, some people never really figured out exactly what they wanted to do. For me, I kind of always knew I wanted to make movies in some capacity.
Were you experimenting with stuff like that when you were a kid?
Yeah, I mean, I remember with when I was maybe eight, me and Philip Geltman were making claymation, stop-motion animation movies in the basement. We're always playing around with video cameras.
And what was your setup back then?
My setup back then? I think we stole his brother's VHS camcorder. We figured out some way to do click-click-click photography with it. And I remember we kind of, there was one instance where we built a skyscraper out of cardboard, and we built a clay King Kong. And I remember it was we were very proud of ourselves. We figured out that we want to make King Kong climb the skyscraper. So we turned it on its side, and we turned the camera on its side, so it wouldn't, you know, so gravity wasn't an issue. So it was a small setup, but you know, we were playing around with arcane technology.
Is that really common? I would imagine when you get to film school, you meet, you know, suddenly you're surrounded by a million classmates that spent their childhoods doing the exact same thing, right?
Sometimes yes and sometimes no. Sometimes when I was in film school, I was actually being like, oh wow, there's some people are here and they just kind of got into this. But there were, yeah, it was nice to finally be around film people.
Were you technical from the beginning, interested in the gear side of the business?
Yeah, I'm not super a gearhead. I've always been interested in the sciences, I suppose.
But you've sort of now got the ultimate gearhead business, right? I mean,
yes, but you know, I'm actually not like the people who actually operate the drones. In my perspective, are the super gearheads. Like, I could not super talk shop with you about the latest, greatest drone stuff. What really like gets me going is like moving the camera in like three dimensions. At the end of the day, we're in the business of making pretty pictures. We're not a drone company. We're a pretty picture making company. So that's kind of what interests me more. In terms of drone cinematography, it's the perfect ability to kind of like take the mind's eye of, you know, you have a vision in your head of what you want to create. Everybody experiences this if you're a creative. You know, you want to write a novel, you want to make a clay sculpture. It's about like removing that little nugget of your vision and putting it onto clay or celluloid or whatever. And with the drone, and why I got interested in it, is because now you have a vision of a shot. And now you can kind of just pluck it out of your head and put it onto, make the camera go wherever you want it to go.
What was your vision in film school? Were you thinking of yourself as a director or a writer, or did you see yourself on the technical side of the business sort of all the way through?
No, I kind of dabbled. I took cinematography classes, I took writing directing classes, I wrote a I wrote a short film that some of my professors thought was very, quote unquote, very mature, and I thought it was, I liked it. I thought it was cool. So I wanted to, you know, be a writer, be a director.
And that's what you did when you graduated, right?
I actually produced a couple of feature films. One of them went to Sundance. I produced a bunch of commercials. And they were all the commercials were like very like technically sophisticated. I was always working with a good friend named Paul Trillo, and we were always coming up with like very complicated ways of doing.
Like, what's an example?
We did a Prius commercial where we took like, 10,000 photographs and we stitched them together to kind of do like a little bit of a claymation or stop motion animation, I should say. No clay involved, but similar principle. We did a Nokia commercial where we strung together like 50 Nokia cameras and did the kind of like a bullet time rig like in the Matrix.
Mm-hmm.
So I've always been like I was always building complicated things to create artful looking things.
Do you write software too? Like, are you a code guy?
I'm not a code guy. Wouldn't know, would turn on a computer, I have no idea what to do with it.
But software has been behind some of the stuff you've done recently.
And I have specialists who do that. I kind of have like an idea of what it should do,
mm-hmm.
and then people execute it.
Got it. So after school, you're working on production, and where does the drone thing come in? What's the genesis of the idea? Did drones even exist? At that time, that started at that point, right?
Well, when I graduated college in 2010, there have been there's been like helicopters and things like that. People have been flying cameras on helicopters for a long 30 years, 40 years or something like that now. And it's funny when you actually watch a helicopter shot from like a movie from the 70s, you go to yourself, how was this acceptable? It was just like ugly and rocky and it's not stable, but it was, for some reason, it was acceptable. When I got out of college, drones were not a thing. And then about 2013, I saw a video of a little drone on YouTube and I just said, holy crap, that's gonna be hot. People are gonna want that. And then I kind of traveled the world a little bit. I went to Canada. I went to Sweden. I went to the Ukraine. I went to what other weird country? I went to a weird country in the middle of Europe. I can't remember the name of it. To essentially buy a big expensive drone, not knowing what the hell I was doing. Ultimately, bought a big expensive drone. Decided to fly into the Ukraine as there was a coup going on in the country. It's a good time to go. I shot a little project of Chernobyl, which was kind of like, in my mind, oh, that's like a really cool like marketing thing. Oh, well, take my big expensive drone, I'll film Chernobyl. Ended up doing that and then got some traction, raised some money, and kind of.
Well, you're leaving out the classic success story of the era, right? Which is that drone video of Chernobyl became a viral hit, right?
Yeah, it did. It was probably I think there's been a lot of poor imitators, but we were definitely like the first to kind of go there and execute that. And it was a wild and crazy experience, as you might imagine. There were. The first drone I bought didn't end up, bought the drone in Sweden, brought it back to the States after Chernobyl, kind of crashed after about 2 weeks, kind of just had a little seizure in the sky and fell out of the sky.
That's unfortunate. How much did you lose on that day?
Let's just say it was a very expensive day, but thank God there was insurance. Well. Had we not gotten insurance, I wouldn't be sitting here probably.
So one of the things that I thought was interesting that I saw that you'd mentioned previously is the idea that a drone sort of achieves like a cinematographer's ultimate fantasy, which is the ability to infinitely move a camera in three dimensions. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean that's like what I'm really like going after. It's unfortunate that it's a drone. It's an unnecessary byproduct. What you really want is you just want to be able to kind of shut your eyes and drift in space and just be able to kind of like shake your hand and you could just see around any object. I mean, in cinema, for whatever reason, we're always impressed by like one shots or like shots that are complicated or things that make you go, how the hell do they do that? How do they pull that off? And the drone is a way to make a camera autonomous. If it was a magic carpet ride or if it was an anti-gravity machine, I would way prefer it because it's a loud spinning prop thing with lithium polymer batteries. And right now, you know, the problem with like drone imaging, as far as I'm concerned, is that, you know, if you're a cinematographer, you have to talk to a crew guy, you have to talk to a drone pilot, you have to talk to a drone camera operator, so that you, the DP, the cinematographer, can kind of like extract what's in your brain, tell it to these two guys, and then one of them flies it, one of them camera ops it, and like they have, and those two guys need to be in sync, and they need to be doing like a song and dance. That's beautiful and poetic and technical and complicated, and there's wind and a lot of other stuff that could go, you know, wrong, and that's variables. But really, the goal is, you know, right now the drone is flying the camera, but ultimately the goal is that, you know, that's wrong. The camera should be flying the drone. Ultimately, people, and it's not just in film, it's in any industry, you know, there's obviously like a lot of like, oh, well, we're going to inspect oil pipelines or whatever. At the end of the day, people who are want to inspect oil pipelines or cell phone towers, they don't really care about flying a drone. That's a byproduct. It's unnecessary. They care about, oh, I want the camera to go over there. I want to look at that.
So the ultimate dream is seamlessness, right? Sort of like, yeah, an intuitive, like where the connection between your eyes and the motion of the machine is invisible.
Yeah, it's emerging of the real world and the digital world. And now there's ways of beginning to do that with augmented reality, virtual reality, which, you know, we're playing around with some techniques where you could, you know, look at an augmented, you could see a 3D model of a location in front of you. It's the future we've been promised from Minority Report, and you could kind of point to a loki. I could look at New York City. I could point to a building here, and the drone will, in the real world, go to that building.
Now this is fascinating, but a question is, how did you decide that this was a business? That this was something that you could do as a living, or even become a company?
Well, that's a great question. I probably didn't think too much about it. I knew that I thought it was cool. I thought, yeah, that's really cool, and I think other people will think it's cool.
Did you envision it as a tool for the entertainment industry? It's like solving problems that you yourself had as a filmmaker.
It wasn't problems that I was having. It was more of the ability to, as I just like kind of described, it was the ability to fulfill that, like, that long desire I've had my whole life as a child of like being able to move a camera anywhere I wanted to in any location. It's a play at that. And it's, it hasn't been 100% achieved yet. When I look back on loving movies my whole life, yeah, I've always been fascinated with those long, complicated shots and like, how do they get the camera to do that? And how do they move that way and this way? And it's really an extrapolate. It's a desire to scratch that itch of being able to just, seamlessly shut your eyes and envision seeing things from perspectives you couldn't before.
What were some of the first steps you took when you decided to make it a business? I mean, was it one of those things where you got the client first and started the business second, or did you start it with a business plan, with partners?
Yeah, so the first, I mean, you know, buying a drone was obviously, seemed critical at the time as something to do if you wanted to fly drones. And then one of the first things I realized I had to do was, in order to actually, like, make money doing this, I needed to get a permission slip from the FAA, which at the time they weren't giving out. So here I had a really big, expensive drone and no legal ability to fly it in the U.S. It was kind of a problem. And I also had no aviation background, and in the drone industry, I'm a little bit of an odd man out, in that most people in the drone industry I found were like people in aviation. It's like, well, like
former Air Force,
yeah,
or something.
Former like Air Force guys or guys who. Guys who were hardcore roboticists, or guys who fly planes, and like those are gearheads. Those are guys who are like RC, like they're at the RC field flying fixed wing craft. I had no experience background in that, so they knew all of this stuff that I had no clue. So I had to figure out a way to kind of write a bunch of FAA paperwork. And at the time, like, nobody told you what to submit. It was kind of like, well, just submit some stuff and we'll see if we approve you or not to fly a drone. So hire an FAA attorney, FAA consultant, filled out made a lot of like documentation about how we were going to operate safely. And then, you know, a year later, I got approved. I was
a quick year later in U.S. government terms,
yes,
right?
Yes, a quick year later. It was funny. I actually, about a month ago, I got a phone call from somebody at the FAA who apologized profusely because he didn't get back to me. And it was 2.5 years ago that I reached out to him.
That's amazing.
Yes.
But so who were your first customers back then? Like what was your business model at the beginning?
At the beginning, the business model was like, all right, well, here's a drone, like we could fly it and,
drones as a service, you might say?
Yeah. Drones as a service. And that's pretty much our business model to this day. You know, we were one of the first approved companies in the U.S. We were the first legal operators in New York and on the East Coast. People found out about us. We had, built kind of a little bit of credibility. We had flown like really big cameras on really big drones. We did a project in Dubai. We did a project where we filmed two really big cameras on a drone, which never been done before. We flew a full-sized Alexa, which is like a very professional camera system. Nobody has done that. So I was kind of like, and I was doing stuff that I didn't know I shouldn't be doing because it was way too dangerous and the technology wasn't like ready for it. But had I known better, you know, again, I might not be here.
You might not be an entrepreneur at all.
Exactly.
That's the entrepreneur story. How'd you end up in Brooklyn?
I've lived in Brooklyn now since for 6 years, 7 years. I was dorming at NYU in the Village. At some point, that got old and tired, and I moved to Brooklyn.
But as a company, you're set up in Brooklyn. Do you feel like that's tell me a little bit about the
How did that happen?
Yeah, the decision to base the company here. In this borough.
Sure. I've always loved trend-setting places, and Brooklyn's hip and it's cool. All my friends live in Brooklyn, and I know like 4 years ago, I was probably one of the first new wave of tenants in Industry City. I have a friend's father who told me about Sunset Park and how there was these guys who were spending a lot of money to revitalize it and make it great again. I went, and before I knew it, I was sub-renting a little space in my friend's father's office in Industry City. And it was before anybody else was really there. It was like at the beginning of their rejuvenation of that spot.
The startup Death Star over there, basically,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
One of the challenges of being in New York, presumably, is that it must be a very challenging place to fly drones. Is that an issue that you face? And I mean,
yes.
Is it legal to fly a drone in New York?
No, it's not.
It's a big
problem.
But you do fly in the city from time to time. How does that work?
No, so we've done a project. For like Oreo and things like that, like you're not allowed to. There's an ordinance you can't take off from city property, so that pretty much means all the five boroughs. If it's private property, you're allowed to. The other big problem is you're kind of blanketed everywhere you look with Class B airspace. So that means that there's a few pockets where that's
airspace that's near an airport.
So you have like JFK, you have like LaGuardia. LaGuardia Airport, 5 miles, cuts through all of Midtown Manhattan and South. So there's an ordinance against it. And then there's Class B airspace. There are people who are being approved to fly in Class Bravo airspace. But it's a difficult permission slip to get.
What would you recommend for someone who's like an enthusiast or someone who's interested in getting started and thinks drones are exciting? Like what would be a good first step?
If you just want to fly, buy a DJI Spark. It's a $600-$700 toy, and go to a flying field and fly it a bit. If you want to start a business, think of a really good idea and a really good business model and a lot of other things.
Do you actually ever fly the drones yourself? Is that something that you're into?
No.
Literally. So you're a drone company operator who doesn't fly drones?
Yeah, people are shocked by that. I have like no interest.
Tell me about the team then. How many people do you have working for?
I think I have about 8 people right now. I have myself, I have like an two operations people. I have two technical people. I have a aeronautical engineer, mechanical engineer, full-time pilot. I'm probably going to hire a third salesperson in the next week or two. And then I kind of have some software people around occasionally. Who else is around?
What are some of the challenges? You have a 2-person sales team already out of 8. That's an interesting ratio for a technical company. Does that reflect the challenges of selling to Hollywood or to the entertainment industry? Like, and how would you recommend? You know, how did you get started doing that?
I mean, it's a business. You could spin your wheels for so long and build cool stuff, but ultimately, if nobody buys it or uses it, what's the point? You'll go out of business. There are a lot of companies in the drone space who spent way too much time, you know, raising way too much money, spinning their wheels, building technology, and couldn't get any customers. We are sales driven. We go out and we find customers. My third sales guy, I want him to start selling into a new industry, which we've started to do. So, yeah, I mean, you know, if you only focus on the technology and like you won't see the forest through the trees.
What are some of the tricks for managing a team of sales for something that's complicated and hard to explain like this?
You know what? I actually don't think it's that complicated. My perspective is, it's, you know, like a complicated piece of software. That's like demos and that's like long sales cycles, and what we're doing right now in the space that we're in, it's high-end aerial video. It's like high-end aerial cinematography. So unlike if you're trying to sell something to an oil and gas company where you're going to have to convince them that, oh, well, if you use a drone to inspect this, it's going to give you an ROI of 3 cents per every cubic meter per every, you have to like figure out like an ROI and like do all this data and like figure, and like that's going to take forever to convince them. With this, it's an aesthetic choice. It's like it's a creative decision that somebody has made. So there's no, they want it or they don't. You know, they don't have to be convinced for too long that they need it.
Speaking of creative, what are some of the more interesting shots that you've ended up fulfilling for people? Anything we've seen?
Yeah, there was one shot in an episode of a TV show called Underground where like we flew from outside of a house, inside a house, to outside of a house, where we're kind of like tracking like a female lead character. That was pretty cool. We did all the aerial cinematography on The Fate of the Eight, Fast and Furious movie. I assume is still out in theaters. And that you could only imagine like the kind of insanity that ensued.
I mean, that's sort of like the franchise for cinematography.
Yes, drive down that city block for 10 blocks and film those cars exploding. All right, cool. There was a project that was like kind of like internally produced, where it was a 10-11 minute short film. There was like 10 actors in it, all dialogue, and it was one continuous drone shot. But you know, the drone is 5 feet off the ground, 100 feet off the ground, and there's a lot of dialogue too. So you can't really, you kind of forget it's a drone. Like, and the point was, I wanted to explore like that idea of just, we're just going to move a camera seamlessly in an environment and see what happens.
That's interesting. How is the progression of these clients, and you know, has the progression of the business, you know, been different from what you'd expected?
Yeah, there's a lot of clients that want to do just crazy, like you know, like there's a cut, like advertisers, you know, they just want to do like crazy stuff, and sometimes they don't have even an idea. They come and they say, oh, you guys did, you know, we've done a couple of cool creative projects. You guys did that. Like, can you do something? It's like, yeah, sure. What do you want? They're like, well, you tell us. And I'm like, all right, well, let's go to the drawing board and figure it. When that gives me a lot of like interesting creative freedom to do stuff. And, you know, drone is just a medium to, again, to have autonomy, to be able to just move about the world in any way. So there's a lot of cool stuff you could do. And, you know, right now we're pitching a cool, very cool thing, and we'll see what happens.
Where do you see this business progressing? Drones. I mean, there's a lot of discussion of drones. I mean, they've certainly, it seems like one of those things where the technology caught up to a certain line and then all of a sudden it explodes. I've seen a lot of talk about things. I mean, Amazon delivery drones. There's a YouTube hit this week of someone getting fast food delivered in a park that they going through the drive-through. Do you think the consumer applications are gonna come in?
Well, I mean, like, you know, consumers are buying drones like crazy. What they're using them for, I have no idea. I mean, my impression is that, you know, people buy them and they get it, they fly it, they crash it, and they go, all right, that's it. like, you know, there's really, like, I don't think, like, the enterprise business, that's where there's going to be a lot of money and a lot of businesses, like, people who are, you know, the entertainment industry, the sector that we're in, they're, let's just say, more progressive, and they're willing to do stuff more immediately. There are other, like, large energy like, who are a little slow to adopt stuff. I often have to remind myself, I was on a panel a couple days ago in Texas for the International Liquid Terminal Association. It's those big terminals that keep gasoline. They wanted to know, and, like, you know, I'm in a room with all these oil and gas guys, and none of them know anything about drones. So I have to pinch myself every now and then and be like, oh, a lot of people still don't know about this stuff. So there's going to be a lot of applications and adoption eventually in industrial industries, inspection industries, but it hasn't. We have not reached peak drone yet, for sure. In terms of deliveries, that's complicated because I have it on somewhat good authority that Amazon is you know, going after deliveries like crazy, but it's regulations, and nobody has any real good insight into when that will ever happen. I mean, when you'll be able to autonomously fly a drone for miles and miles over people's heads.
You talk about the regulations for people who don't know. One of them is that there's the line of sight and there's the size and weight restrictions. Like, what is that? How does that constrain the business?
Sure. So, like I said, you can't fly within 5 miles of an airport without, like, special permission. That could often take a months to get. So that's difficult. And you actually don't realize that, you know, people from LA and New York, they think the only airports in the country are LAX and JFK. It's actually, like, thousands of airports all across the country. And when you look at a map, you really start to, like, and there's restricted airspace, there's national parks, which you can't fly in, there's military bases, you know, there's all sorts of, like, airspace that's just off limits. So that's kind of a no-go. You can't fly drones over 55 pounds.
That's got to be a huge issue for you as well, for the higher end cameras and stuff and for delivery.
Yeah, that's
true. Just a hard limit, right?
That's just a hard limit, and that's, you know, federal law, and it would take Congress to change it at this point. It's my understanding. You know, according to Amazon, 90-something% of their packages are 5 pounds or under. So there are actually a lot of problems with kind of pulling that off. There's energy pop problems and battery problems and deployment issues and to go back to the regulatory, flying at night is possible, but you need a special permission slip, which we have, so we could, like, operate at night. You can't fly over people, which for, like, news gathering and really for any delivery thing, that kind of puts the kibosh on that.
Is that really enforced? I mean, how do you, like, is there an exception for, like, a film production? I mean, like, are you not flying over people when you're doing, like, the Fast and Furious or something?
So you could actually so there was a 333 exemption, which we operated under for a year or so. That was, like, the first way to get drone permission. That you could actually fly over people.
What does that mean? 333.
That was just the what they call it, a 333 exemption. That was just,
it was,
like,
a law.
That was the exemption from the fact that there was no law, and that was, like, the initial permission slip. Now under Part 107, it's actually a little bit looser. Before, you needed a pilot's license. Now you don't need a pilot's license. Now you need a Part 107 certificate. So literally, you could walk into LaGuardia today and take a 30-minute, 40-minute, like, written exam, like a multiple choice sort of questionnaire, and if you pass, you get a little license that says you're a drone pilot and can operate. But you have to know things about the airspace and things of that nature to operate.
And does everybody now need to have some kind of permit to fly a drone?
Or you can't.
The hobbyist, there's no hobbyist exemption at all.
The hobbyist, I think, needs to. There was just a new ruling. The hobbyists, I think, needed to register their aircraft. Now they don't need to register their aircraft. But if they're not doing it for business, they don't need to have a 107. I believe. No, they still need to have a 107.
So just to fly in the park, you need permission.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Well, interesting. Before we go, is there any advice that you'd give for entrepreneurs or someone who's got an idea in turning it into an actual day job?
Advice. I would say that if it's your first time doing it, you're going to make mistakes at the beginning, and it's okay to make mistakes. But don't let it deter you, and don't let the mistakes be so bad that it ruins you. It is possible, you know, it is possible to make it's not about doing everything right. Sometimes it's about not doing the one thing that will ruin you.
Good answer. Well, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
You've been listening to From Day One, How Brooklyn Entrepreneurs Got Their Start. This series is made possible by a grant from the Made in New York Media Center in conjunction with The Bridge, a news site dedicated to reporting on business in Brooklyn. For more from The Bridge, to learn more about today's guest, or to listen to more episodes of From Day One, visit us at thebridgebk.com. That's thebridgebk.com. From Day One is produced by Kim Thornton, Steve Kep, and myself, Nick Bailey. Audio editing and post-production by Al Sigman. The From Day One logo was created by Joe Meyer, and our theme music was performed by Jody Rockwell and the Ambulamps. Thanks for listening.